aerosols.
Well, one of them got a brain tumor. Died of it.
The College and Veterans Committee will come to order. First bill up today will be Senate File 642, Senator Sparks, drainage ditch buffer requirements modifications.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, for the opportunity to present Senate File 642 in front of you today. Back in 2005, the Minnesota legislature directed the Board of Soil and Water Resources to conduct an assessment of the use, maintenance, and benefits of the required grass strips along public drainage ditches in consultation with the stakeholders. That effort produced the Public Drainage Ditch Buffer Study in February of 2006, and the bill that's before you today, Mr. Chair and members, is the work that was done with that. I know that you have a lengthy agenda, and so with that, I have with me today to testify Doug Thomas, the Assistant Director of the Board of Soil and Water Resources, and Harlan Madsen, Candy Ho-High County Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Doug Thomas, Board of Water and Soil Resources. As Senator Sparks said, we've been at this for a little over 2 years. The board facilitated a drainage work group, and one of the goals that emerged from that work group was the need to increase the number of miles of our open public drainage ditches in the state that are buffered for a lot of good reasons. The bill in front of you today reflects those consensus recommendations. And the bill really does three things. It is all limited to changes in the Minnesota drainage law, and it clarifies language in the ditch law in relationship to the location and width of buffers. It is designed to remove impediments to promote and piggyback with existing state and federal programs like CRP and RIM, removing some of the impediments that we found to promoting and utilizing those programs. And lastly, to provide some enhanced authority to our drainage authorities to implement buffers in an incremental approach and at less cost to the benefited properties. With that, you do should have in your packet a bill overview, and I will kind of quickly go through that. You also have in your packet a sheet that includes all of the groups that have provided letters of recommendation, and I think you can see that includes everything from the statewide farm organizations to statewide environmental organizations and conservation organizations. And so we had a lot of input, and these are the groups that have provided formal letters of support with relating to the consensus recommendations. And then the other side of that sheet is simply where the money landed on the House side in the bill, the companion bill over there, what the Senate finance recommendations were, and what the governor's recommendations were. So there's a summary of that information for you as well. Just to walk through the bill for you very quickly, Section 1 of the bill is changes the use of the word grass to permanent vegetation. And the reason for that was we discovered through our process a number of situations where a ditch can go through a wetland, it can go through a forested area, as well as through cropland. And simply requiring using grass, the literal interpretation is that you'd have to cut down the trees on one side, on both sides of the ditch if you did a project, and plant grass. That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. And that definition of permanent vegetation is determined by the drainage authority. So they're the ones that are in the position of determining what it is that has to be planted on that buffer strip. Section 1 of the bill also addresses one of the things that really started this whole discussion, and that is clarifying the point of beginning for where the ditch buffer is measured from, where it starts and where it ends. And then in the case of redetermination benefits and damages, the bill limits the width of the buffer to 16.5 feet. And basically prior to this, there was a debate that was not necessarily uniform about what happens when with a project where you're not moving any dirt, where you're simply going out there and doing a redetermination of benefits and damages. There was a lot of concern about how that strip could be much further out because the spoil bank could have been spread 30 years ago. It could be out 30 feet. It could be very irregular. So we made it very clear that for a distinction between new ditches and ditches that are being repaired or improved where they're moving dirt, versus those projects where they're not moving any dirt, which would be a straight redetermination of benefits and damages. Sections 2 and 3 of the bill are conforming changes, which simply, again, replace grass with the term perennial vegetation. Section 4 of the bill is the portion of the bill that creates a new authority for the state's drainage authorities, which are the state's counties and watershed districts. Those are the two drainage authorities in the state. And what it does is it allows them to incrementally approach a ditch project and have buffers established on that ditch without going through the full-blown redetermination of benefits and damages, and simply allows them to go through a determination of damages, which is a much less costly procedure for them, but still requires them to go through the full public disclosure, public notice, and due process that you would have to, as they would for any other proceeding under the ditch law. So it provides for that same process, but again, gives them a kind of a new incremental approach. We think this is one of the key things to increase the use of programs like CRP on the federal side and RIM on the state side, where you could then piggyback with those programs and achieve that grass buffer and do so at a much less cost to the benefited property owners, because you're able to maximize the use of a federal program and then the local requirement for the buffers. Section 5 of the bill adds some small annual reporting requirements on the part of drainage authorities, which would simply require them to report the number and types of actions for which viewers are appointed, the number of miles of buffers that are established each year and according with the ditch law, the number of inspections that they conduct, and the number of violations of the buffer strip requirement that are identified, and what were the enforcement actions that were taken. Section 6 of the bill clarifies, again, it's one of these things that were viewed as an impediment. We've had a number of instances through the drainage work group where folks had talked about county attorneys who said that if you do a repair of a ditch and you put the spoil on CRP land, it is not the ditch authority's responsibility to spread that soil and to reseed it to the similar vegetation that is out there for CRP. It's kind of a catch-22, because with that ruling, that landowner potentially is in violation of their CRP contract for no action of their own other than the ditch being cleaned out. So this makes it clear in the ditch law that it is the responsibility of the ditch authority, that they have to conduct and carry out those repairs and pay for those repairs out of their repair and maintenance fund when that specific kind of situation exists. Section 7 of the bill, again, is simply a conforming change with grass to perennial vegetation. Section 8 of the bill is similar to Section 6, and again, it is one of those areas where we felt that it was made a lot of sense to clarify, again, that damages must be paid for the restoration of a federal or state conservation practice that's damaged by a repair. And that could be projects installed under the state cost share program, the federal EQIP program, or things like CRP and RIM again. Just makes it clear that that's a responsibility of the ditch authority, not a responsibility of the landowner. Section 9 of the bill, right now, current language in ditch law requires that drainage ditches shall be regularly inspected, but it didn't define what regular means. And I think the group agreed that 30 years is probably not regular. And so this change would require that for open drainage ditches, that the minimum would be once every 5 years that the drainage authority would be required to do an inspection of that ditch. Sections 10, 11, and 12, again, are conforming changes, and Section 11 are the appropriation pieces. And with that, that's kind of a quick overview, and happy to answer any questions that you may have.
I'm going to have to just step in 1 minute. Let the record show a quorum is present. Do your other gentlemen want to add to it, and then I'll take questions? That'd be okay?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Harlan Madsen. I'm a county commissioner from Candy High County. I am a dairy farmer for 35 years and a commissioner for 13. This is, I think, the second time in my 13 years there's been a discussion and even a bill proposed as far as drainage law. And I want to assure you that this particular bill is not going to tear apart the fabric of rural Minnesota or urban Minnesota. It is, and as you see by the sheet in your packet, it is a very diverse committee. I have had the privilege of sitting on the Drainage Work Group for the last 2 years. I started when I was president of the Association of Counties. We have some very diverse and very significantly different philosophies in some of the group. But as we discussed, and as we moved into this, one of the things that I do think that we were all appreciative of is the legislature challenging us and allowing us to discuss these very issues, to bring forward by consensus, after much angst in many situations, a bill that makes very good sense for this state. Mr. Thomas and Mr. Keene from the Bowser have been an excellent asset, and I want to thank them and again acknowledge their assistance. As we began looking at the ditch buffer bill, which is referred to, we discussed, we positioned, we were tense, we were determined, we gathered information, we educated each other, we dialogued, we disagreed, but we built trust and built relationships. We built understanding, and we came to a desired outcome that we wanted to be positive. We wanted to reduce sedimentation, improve water quality, reduce erosion, reduce ditch maintenance, increase the miles of buffer strips along ditches, enhance the ability of drainage authorities to accomplish that task, and we wanted to look at the various agencies, the various individuals, the various enforcers, and say, how can we get these people to work together and not have convoluted and conflicting regulations and rules? Certainly, as a committee, we support this bill. It's a very important first step in addressing some of the situations with drainage. And I would submit to you as a committee, and I think we would speak, I would speak on behalf of our entire committee, the Drainage Work Group, that we need to begin addressing, rather than the word drainage, we need to look at stormwater management, because drainage ditches are not just farm ditches. They are urban. They cover all of us. And I think it behooves us as a state to look at this in a broader perspective rather than pointing fingers in some situations at me as a farmer or as a homeowner or as an industry. We're all in this together at that point. And that is, if there's one thing that stood out in my mind, is the ability of this committee, with your charge and your challenge, the ability of this committee to put together consensus over a period of time. That type of relationship is a must, and it worked very, very well. We, again, support this legislation. It is a very important first step. As we move into the future years of discussing water, certainly looking at the financials there and that just looking at the records, looking at the drainage assistance team, those are valuable components. Our diverse group says, give us the tools. As a drainage authority member, I tell you, empower us, challenge us, help us to clarify, give us transparency, and challenge us and guide us to do it locally. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I was just wondering, down in the county I live in, they put those strips on there themselves, but they got paid for a government program of some kind to go out so many feet. Does this qualify for that?
Mr. Chairman, the answer would be yes.
Okay, and then not only is it good for the ditch, it's good for the wildlife because the pheasants are just thick along that ditch. Okay, Senator Kubley, did you have your hand up?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chairman. I guess just a quick question for the witnesses. This looks like a pretty good bill to me, but you know, I guess, I think there are, do we know enough about the native species that covered the state at one time so that we know what kinds of species might be native species to a local ecotype that's found on page 2, lines 23 and 4?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kubley, I think the DNR does maintain, and that was actually, there's some discussion on the House side about this, where that piece originated from. Going back to page 1, if you look at line 1.19 of the bill, and it really speaks to preference should be given. It's not mandating in the bill the requirement of native vegetation to be used are native grasses and forbs, but that preference should be given to that. And local ecotype is a definable term in that the state is broken up into a number of ecoregions, and there's a number of classes that are assigned in there, which kind of say if you're in the northern hardwood forest, for example, and that encompasses these areas, these are kind of where you should be looking at in terms of what are the natives that do best in that area. But again, this does not mandate natives. We felt very strongly that we need to encourage it, but it's too early and too soon for us and to kind of move into saying where you just have to do that.
Okay. No, thank you. That's helpful.
Senator Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sparks, thank you. And gentlemen, my question is related to Senator Kubley's, and I'm glad he asked it because I had the same question. So you're saying that there is a list, a resource list, that people could refer to then if they choose to go with a native species, there's a list as a resource. Okay. Then my other question is related, and you have to forgive me because I have an extensive background in horticulture, so these kinds of things just pop right out. But when it says that you're going to be allowing perennial vegetation approved by the drainage authority, and then when you're moving from grass to perennial vegetation, can you speak to what those decisions were about? Why are you moving from grass to perennial vegetation, and then what is the perennial vegetation, and is there an approved list? Could you speak about that a little bit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ropes, again, as I mentioned early on, we found a couple things as we went through the inventory and the study that was done 2 years ago, and that's many, many miles of ditches in the state are not what you think of as typically cropland. They're in forested areas, they're in urban areas, and they go through wetlands. And to simply use the word grass is somewhat archaic and also problematic in the situation. If somebody could say, literally come along and say, you've done an improvement on this ditch, the law says you have to plant grass, go cut down 16 and a half feet of trees alongside the ditch and plant grass there. That was one reason for recognizing the term perennial vegetation. So it could be trees, it could be allowing the natural wetland vegetation to regrow, or it could be native grasses and forbs. Again, grass by definition does not include some of the forbs and legumes that you might associate as well with a permanent, you know, vegetated buffer strip. So that was really to try to gain some being a little more expansive and inclusive in the term rather than just simply using grass. And as far as the second part of your question in terms of approved by the drainage authority, we felt that was critical in there because the drainage authority is the one that's responsible for the inspection and the maintenance. And we wouldn't want situations where somebody might come in and plant something that could actually be a detriment to maintaining the ditch, where it could, you know, a fast-growing tree which might grow quickly, fall over, get into the ditch, plug up the water, or, you know, if beavers are a problem, you might not want to be planting, you know, certain things. And so it gives them the ability to decide what that perennial vegetation should be and then to enforce it through their inspection and maintenance activities on an ongoing basis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. I think it's great that you have recognized that there's different cultural requirements, and grass doesn't grow in heavy shade. If you're a heavy shaded area, then you're going to wind up having an area that basically contributes to soil erosion. So that's good. The only thing I'm concerned about is that, you know, especially if we are always looking at costs, that sometimes you go to a really low-cost seed. I know we have plenty of hillsides, for example, of crown vetch around the state, and you know I just hate to see some of our ditches just overrun with low-cost perennial vegetation that's not particularly good for the environment. So, is there going to be some qualitative judgment calls along the way, as well as you know what's economical to put in?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ropes, if I may, Doug. One of the discussions that we had, Senator, that I think was very important is not only reducing impediments, but looking at the local and the very diverse state that we have in selecting the appropriate vegetation for those slopes. One of the hopes that I have as a drainage authority member is that at the conclusion of the session that we have a bill that has the funding for a drainage assistant team, for the best management practices manual and the updates, those are where those items will be included. There's no sense in reinventing the wheel. Let's make sure we get people talking with each other, and clearly there are vegetation that would be undesirable. And again, the hope, I think the commitment of the committee is that we have those lists and we have those dialogues and we have that education component so that we are doing the best that we possibly can that still comes under the guise of efficiency and common sense.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very glad to hear that. And, of course, I'll just put in my 2 cents for the native species, because I think in the long run, although it might be a little bit more expensive up front, for the long term, health and even the economics of planting an area, you know, if you have a native species that's meant to grow in poor soil, in the sun, if that's what the situation is, you're going to be better served to put in a native species that fits that cultural environment. So, and save money, a lot of money in the long run. Thank you very much.
Senator Wergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for my voice. I have some questions concerning the bill. Commissioner Madsen, anyone that's ever served on a county board and simultaneously on a ditch authority never forgets some of those meetings, do they? I can tell you all about Ditch 15 in Sherburne County. The cost of any maintenance and repair to a ditch is passed on to the farmer. And so our agricultural community is always significantly affected by everything we do with a ditch, a drainage ditch. Although I will grant you, I'm fully aware that having been in a very growing county, that some of those ditches are not strictly agricultural by any means. We, as a matter of fact, did develop some drainage authority and turn some ditches over to cities, literally. So that does exist. But when a ditch is clean, there are some areas that the grass cover has worked very well. It's effective, and it does prevent the erosion from happening. And when you start to look at some of the other perennial species, and you start to look at especially some of the native species, you can drastically increase the cost to a farmer, for instance, that is running through an entire quarter section or half section or whatever the case might be, because there are some of those. There are farmers that have as much as a mile of ditch running through their farm. And so when you talk about the cost of planting an acre of ditch bank, that's 16 and a half feet from the top of the bank, you can increase the cost of that drainage repair or modification significantly through what we're doing here. Will the farmer automatically have this cost passed on to them? Because not only will it create a great cost, it also could in some cases create a continued erosion for a period of time, because some of the native species take as long as 5 years to establish a good root system. And so if you're not very careful, I think you're actually creating a situation where the ditch could have to be cleaned again before the native species is established. And then when you're cleaning the ditch, if you disrupt that native species, although I realize that it says that future cleaning of the ditch cannot be impaired, I find that hard to believe that that could happen, because when you clean a ditch, you automatically affect the easement alongside of the ditch. You don't have a choice. And almost always you have to replant. And so when you're cleaning the ditch after the native plants have been established, it's been 3 to 5 years, you tear them out, you again are going to cost that same farmer a lot more money in replacing some of what you're requesting here. So I think this actually creates some problems. I'm not real thrilled with this piece of legislation. I understand that a group of people worked on it, but I think there are greater implications than we're acknowledging are in this bill.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Senator Wergen, I think it's important to note, Senator, that they are not required as far as the native forbs. It is an option at that point, and this only kicks in when there is an improvement or a new ditch. It is not for all repairs. which you're talking about cleanouts and that type of thing. So we're looking at a very narrow segment that would be affected, and that is one reason. We did discuss, Senator, some of the same concerns that you raised as far as are we causing problems by addressing the longevity as far as establishing there. The commitment of the work group was to remove the impediments, to look at establishing something on a permanency, again, particularly for new ditches and for improved ditches. We're not looking at every single one at this point in time.
No.
So it would narrow the perspective, the scope.
Well, Mr. Chair, a couple more questions. On 1.19 and 1.20 page and line, it says preference should be given to planting native species of a local ecotype. Who gets that preference, the county board at the expense of the farmer or the farmer because he has to pay for it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wergen, again, the drainage authority is the one who makes the decision as to what they're going, you know, what is going to be planted out there. So the drainage authority could require, you know, permanent vegetation includes grass. It includes, grass and legumes that could be annually harvested at hay by that producer if it's in an ag area. But again, it provides some flexibility to the drainage authority to make that decision. This is not being mandated upon them to do something different than what they choose to do. So they can take what you said, the local conditions, the factors involved. Is it an urban setting? Is it an agricultural setting? Is it a forested setting? And they can look at that, and they can then say what is the vegetation that is going to be put on that strip. As Commissioner Manson said, again, this does not apply if it's simply a repair or maintenance procedure. The grass buffer strip requirement in law, which has been there since 1977, it doesn't change that at all, is that when you do a new ditch, an improvement to a ditch, or a redetermination of benefits and damages, it's at that point in time at which the grass buffer strip requirement goes into place. And then as far as who pays, the drainage authority, the maintenance fund, and all the funds, as you correctly stated, go back to the benefited properties. The benefited properties is a large area that attributes to that. That goes into the fund, and any damages that are incurred by that landowner where the ditch passes over is paid for then out of that repair maintenance fund, or in the case of a new ditch or an improvement ditch, out of that construction fund that is funded through those assessments.
Mr. Chair, but basically the bottom line is that the farmer won't have a choice, but the farmer will pay the price at whichever point this is done. I mean, that's very clear in what you were saying. And I need to ask the question, have you ever heard of a situation where someone came and said, cut the trees down and plant the grass? I can't even imagine that. I've never heard of it happening.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wergen, in fact, it has, and it happened in a situation up in Thief River Falls on a ditch project up there that involved the Thief River itself. Because you got to understand, some ditches are also part of what we think of as a stream that isn't even been straightened. It's considered part of a ditch system. It may be the lower, you know, mile or two before it empties into a large river. So there actually has been situations where that has been pressed for in the past.
Mr. Chair, I'm Mr. Thomas, I'm well aware of how confusing it can be with a county ditch. I remember well after subdivisions came in and people coming and thinking they lived along a creek when in fact they lived along either a judicial, private, or county ditch. And there are significant implications as to what type of a ditch it is also. So, and I don't know without going back to the statute, does this apply to private, judicial, and county ditches, all three?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wergen, this only applies to those ditches that are defined as a public drainage system under the state drainage law, Chapter 103E. Judicial ditches, by their very nature, have all basically, by definition, become public drainage systems. So it's only the ones that the county, has identified where there's an assessment area for it, and usually, in that case. So it does not apply to private ditches.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to finish in saying that I have significant concerns for the impact that this will have on farmers, especially that own a section of land or whatever, or have multiple ditches through their acreage.
Well, Senator Wergens, I could, I will tell you what goes on in part of the county that I live in. I take care of my ditches because we cleaned them out, and the rule is if you cause damage to that ditch, you're going to be the one that's going to clean it up. The rest of us shouldn't have to. So I take care of mine, and I got a neighbor that puts, he's got three-wheel tractor, and he puts two wheels over in the open space because he wants to get every acre. That's got to stop because all he does is fill up the ditch, and then the rest of us have to put our money out there to clean out the ditch. So I think it's a good idea. As far as trees go, that's the most worthless nuisance that you can have in a ditch is trees. I mean, the beaver will come if nothing else and jam up the ditch. So we try to keep the trees out of there altogether. Well, that might be different up in northern Minnesota where you have, you know, trees everywhere. But down in where I come from, we just don't want trees down there. You can't get rid of them.
Well, Mr. Chairman, on that point, I don't want trees in my ditch either because where I've got those box elder trees growing in ditches, there's no grass growing. So the banks are at greater risk of erosion. So I want the trees out of there so the grass grows down right down to the bottom of the ditch and protects that sidewall.
Senator Skye.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I listened to Senator Wergen, I was hoping she'd make a motion, but she didn't, so I'm going to. I think she made a point with regard to this native species that we should leave that to the local jurisdiction to decide what is best. We don't need the words preference should be given to planting native species. I would move on page 2, line 23, after the period to remove preference should be given to planting native species of on line 24, a local ecotype.
Mr. Chairman, you may want to do, I don't know if you were, Senator Skye, if you wanted to do that, and also on page 1, it's in two places. It's also page one line 19 also.
Thank you, Mr. Knopf. I would do that on page 1, line 19 and 20 also.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Senator Skye, that was language that was added in the House, so I would view that as a friendly amendment.
Okay. Everybody understand Senator Skye's motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
No. Chair's in doubt. All those in favor, raise your hand. Those opposed? Motion is adopted. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm not sure who can answer this, and I'm just on page 3 of the bill, in line 3.19, what does that mean? Number of types of actions for which viewers were appointed. And I noticed in the handout that you gave us that you talk about drainage ditches when viewers are appointed. And in the chart of the ditch, it talks about improvement and repair proceedings that appoint viewers. I'm not familiar with that, and I don't have the same background as Senator Wergen and have not ever gotten familiar with ditches other than from a distance.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, the appointment of viewers is for establishing a new ditch or an improvement or redetermining the benefits of the ditch. When you appoint viewers, it is independent individuals that come in to look at the benefits and damages, establish the assessment role, and that section says this applies only when those conditions are present.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
You have to remember, if you've had a ditch that's been there maybe 30, 40 years, the farming has changed. Everybody else is draining into that ditch, but they pay no part of the ditch. And so the redetermination of benefits, look at that whole system around there and see how many others should be helping pay for it. That's it's a job that I wouldn't want because you don't make any friends with it. But it's a fairness issue.
That's right.
Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair, I need a little help, too, and council can help me, but I think what we'd like to do, if someone could help me out, is delete Section 13. That's the appropriation section, because the money part of this bill is traveling in a different vehicle. And I would defer to council just to make sure that that's correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, it'd be just deleting Section 13, as Senator Sparks talked about. This the money, although not exactly what's in here, is appropriated in the omnibus bills, basically of the
Senate Council. The easiest thing would be to strike all of Section 13.
Mr. Chairman, just page 6, delete Section 13.
All the way down to both sides. Okay. Senator Sparks, is it okay? Senator Scoy moves that we strike all of Section 13 appropriations. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Senator Sparks. Members, any other questions? If not, Senator Scoy moves that Senate File 642 as amended be recommended passed and be referred to the floor. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
So adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What was that?
I heard that.
The guy that made the motion voted against it.
Okay, now we're going to
make the motion.
Senator Olson.
Oh, yeah.
County Fairgrounds Recreational Camping Regulations Exemption, and I do have a person from the Department of Health. If that person would like to come up.
Mr. Chair, she's coming.
Colleen Palouse, did I say it right? I'm a real killer on names, so. Welcome to the committee, and let's hear from you, Senator, and then we'll.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a bill that came from the Isani County, the Fair Board Association. They have a number of events going on at their fair and so they're limited camping space during the fair. So they were wondering about smaller spaces, and so that's kind of where this bill is from. And I do have an A1 amendment that should address. It's very similar to the state fair bill, and that just ties that on to the camping at the state fair.
Senator Ropes moves the adoption of the A1 amendment. So get the bill in order that you'd like to have it.
Yes.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Now your bill is in the way you'd want it, Senator Ropes?
Yes, it is.
And let's hear about it, Tom.
Well, the health department had some concerns, and I will let her address those.
Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Chair and Senators, my name is Colleen Paulus. I'm manager of the Environmental Health Services section with the Minnesota Department of Health. Amendment that you have before you is just basically putting the language to an existing statute for camping so that we would have consistent language and it wouldn't be in two different statutes, it just would be in one place. We do, as a department, delegate our authority to local public health, and so that we have consistency in application throughout the state by both state and local inspectors, it'd be advantageous to have the language all in one location.
Yeah. Members, are there any questions? I know a lot of people camp at the state fairgrounds. I know that. I don't know how far apart they are, but they have to get a permit, I believe a permit, in order to do it. So we're talking about state fair, and also this rule would be the same as a small county fair. Am I right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
I'm going to Senator Scoy, and then I'll come back to you, Senator Engelbrecht.
Oh, I thought there weren't any other questions. I was going to move the bill.
Senator Engelbrecht?
Mr. Chair, just a question. How does this fare up with the state campgrounds? Same thing? I'm sorry. Maybe I'm missing something here.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Engelbrecht, it lines it up exactly right. There were two bills, or there is existing law You can see it there, 327.201 is the state fair, and then this just adds that to the state fair language. So it is the same language, and the same requirements for the campgrounds at the state fair would be for county fairs also.
Okay, just a follow-up question. Just camp in the state parks, I mean, I meant to ask you. I'm sorry. Camp in the state parks, is that somewhat similar or no?
Mr. Chair, Senator Engelbretson, no, they would not be similar. That's kind of what drove this, because there's a, I believe it's a 2,000 square foot limitation around a campsite. But during these county fairs, space is at a premium because they rent space out for booths and those kinds of things. So that's why they requested to have a smaller, this goes down to 300 square feet per campsite. So it's considerably smaller than the rest of the year also.
Sleep standing up.
Any other discussion? Mr. Skoy, would you like to move the bill?
Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 1432 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Senate floor.
Senator Skoy moves that Senate File 1432 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the floor of the Senate. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you.
Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. We have before you a simple resolution, which you'll recognize, and I do have an amendment I'd like to offer at A2. It's a delete all.
We'll pass that out as soon as we can here, Senator Harrison.
It's coming wrong.
Or can you just? Okay.
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This basically is a resolution to Congress to continue the authorization of the Conservation Reserve Program in the Federal Ag Bill. I'm not sure what the time frame for that is. If anybody's been watching the Ag Bill, I think it would be this committee, but I'm not unaware of the exact time when they think it will be completed. It's obviously a voluntary federal program that protects millions of acres all over American topsoil from erosion and safeguards a nation's soil and water resources at the same time that it benefits farmers all over the country. And I'm just going through some of the points in here. Approximately 33,000 Minnesota farms participate in the CRP program, which commits approximately 1,800,000 acres of our state's most environmentally sensitive areas for a protection period of up to 10 to 15 years. And Minnesota farmers have instituted conservation and erosion control on the acres, thankfully, including planting trees and native grasses. And some of your discussion here sounds like what we do in Environment Committee every day. Installing filter strips, riparian buffers, and restoring wetlands to important wildlife, including native and migrating waterfowl. Through the CRP program, Minnesota farmers remove a lot of environmentally sensitive acres and plant them with cover crops, which, of course, save a lot of headaches for everybody. The Wetlands Reserve Program is a voluntary federal program in which Minnesota landowners protect, store, restore, enhance wetlands on their property. It's another thing we talk about in environment all the time, thereby improving the wetland values and functions and providing valuable wildlife habitat, which is pretty important. CRP program and the Wetlands Reserve Program have the ability to sequester carbon, and that's another topic we have in common with this committee, sequestering carbon. In addition to providing the erosion control and water quality protection. In 2006, there were approximately 14,500 acres enrolled in the Wetlands Reserve Program in Minnesota, and that's approximately 10% of the program acreage nationwide, representing approximately that much. We trail only behind Arkansas and Nebraska. The United States Department of Agriculture decisions regarding rental rates, appraisals, eligibility, and maintenance have limited enrollment in the CRP program. But they're well below the amount of acres authorized in the O2 Farm Bill. And so we are asking that the legislature of the state of Minnesota urge the U.S. Department of Agriculture to utilize authority they have to offer general sign-up enrollments during 07 with competitive market rental rates. hopefully to achieve the enrollment of acres authorized for the CRP program in the O2 Farm Bill. And be it further resolved that the legislature urge Congress to reauthorize the CRP program with an enrollment cap of 45 million acres and the Wetlands Reserve Program as part of the 07 Farm Bill. And finally, be it further resolved that the Secretary of State of Minnesota prepare copies of this memorial and transmit them to the Speaker and the Clerk of the House of Representatives, the President and the Secretary of the United States Senate, the Secretary of the United States Department of Agriculture, the chairs of the congressional committees with jurisdiction over ag, and Minnesota's senators and representatives in Congress.
To get your bill in order that you'd like to have it, Senator Chaudhry would move the adoption of the A2 amendment. Any discussion? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Now your bill should be in order that you'd like to have it.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of witnesses who might like to make a few comments, at your will.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. Just very briefly, we're here to support the this resolution as the Farm Bill expires in September of 2007, and we support reauthorizing CRP and also WRP, which was added into this. It's kind of interesting to notice 33,000 farms. That's more than a third of the farms that we have in Minnesota are in that program, if that's correct. That's a lot, you know, especially up if you get up in the Senator Scoy's district where 25% of the land in a lot of those counties are marginal land are enrolled in CRP. If you go into the Pine County where I live, it's less than 1%, but we could always use a little bit more in some of those areas that are sensitive land. So it's been a good program also for sportsmen. I also mentioned Colin Peterson, Congressman Peterson, is seeking to add an extra 5 million acres nationwide to the CRP-type program to use to grow cellulosic ethanol-type crops that would also work with a CRP. And we would like to just, since I had it, I just want to mention a couple of tweaks to it. And one we'd like to see is more flexibility in grazing those CRP lands that we're working with at the federal level so that there's times we can use that land also for grazing. So just wanted to mention that and appreciate your support for this resolution. Thank you.
Have a question, Senator Engelbretson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you could answer the question. Weed control, is there weed control with CRP and how does that work? And how much per acre does the farmer get on an average from the federal government for CRP? Just information for me only.
Mr. Peterson, do you know?
Senator Vickerman, I don't know on the actual payment rates now. On CRP, I think CRP has been competitive. We have had also a CREP in Minnesota, a CREP, that piggybacks on CRP, and those rates hadn't been as competitive. They have brought those rates up so that they're a lot more competitive, but it's, I don't know, the Bowsers here too, they have probably a good idea of what it is. It's several hundred dollars an acre. And there is weed control, managed what you plant and everything too on those programs, so don't know offhand. But.
Senator Engelbretson, I don't know if there's one price that fits all because I think different counties in different areas make a difference.
Okay.
You have another witness.
Mr. Chairman, it's just my name's Jerry Schoenfeld. I just thought I might be able to help answer the question a little bit because I tried to enroll my own farm in CRP last year. So, first of all, there is a requirement that the weeds have to be controlled. And one of my clients that I work with is the farm equipment dealers. And they tell me that they sell a lot of these batwing-type mowers in order to go out and cut weeds to control. And you can also use some pesticide application for noxious weeds. In addition to that, but you can't wreck the CRP. In addition to that, I can tell you just on an anecdotal sort of a point that I have a farm in Waseca County, and the rates range, depending upon soil type on that particular farm, from about $98 an acre up to about $155. Now, to give you a comparison to that, land rents in that area for good corn ground up until now, which has gone through the roof this year, but up until last year, we're in the $130 to $150 range.
Edwin Rental.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Schoenfeld, what are they now? Since last year, what's the trend?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, you mean land rents?
Yeah.
Well, because of the Mr. Chairman, Senator, because of the increased price of corn, which has gone from about $2.40, I suppose, a year ago, up to about $3.70 more recently. I guess my corn colleague could tell you more. But and I think presently is about $3.30 to $3.40 local market. That has driven land rents up considerably, and I can tell you that in southern Minnesota, there are people still getting land rents at $120 or $130 an acre, but there are also some people, at least rumored, to be up to $225 an acre. So,
Mr. Schoenfeld, that's not a rumor. That's
Mr. Chairman, it is. I agree that it's fact, but I'm hesitant to suggest that somebody's foolish enough to pay that amount. So.
Just to follow up then, does the price of the payment from the federal government reflect that increase?
No.
No? Okay.
Thank you.
Let's hear from your other witness down there.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Members, my name is Valerie Jarek, and I do represent the Minnesota Corn Growers Association, and Senator Parasol asked that we come and support this resolution. The corn growers in Minnesota are working with the National Corn Growers Association to see that the Farm Bill reauthorizes the CRP program. So we are fully in support of submitting this resolution to Congress.
I think members had the privilege of going out to Washington with the other ag chairs in all the United States. They're all concerned about what could happen to the CRP acres if they take them out and plow them up. And so I think the bill comes at a good time because they're putting that big bill together. And what this would do, the way I read it, it would send a message to Congress that we'd just soon leave those acres where they are. I think that I'm speaking.
Mr. Chairman,
right.
I would say Minnesota cares, and it cares about its farmers, it cares about its land, and a lot of other good things.
Any other discussion? I need somebody. Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 1274 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor.
Senator
Environment?
Murphy.
Environment.
I can't do that because Environment Policy Committee has asked for the bill.
Yep.
So that's where it'll go.
I'll make it Environment.
Okay. Members, Senator Murphy moves that Senate File 1274 as amended be recommended passed and be referred to the Environmental Policy Committee. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? So adopted.
Mr. Chairman, members.
Next bill up is Gimsey, Senator Gimsey.
It's major bill.
See, that should be Senate File 8. I mean, House, we're going on the House File 878.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for having me to hear House File 878. This bill would make the Commissioners of Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Health consultants to the Board of Animal Health. And with me today, I have Quinn Cheney and Bob Hartman to answer any questions that you might have on this mega bill.
Well, it might look like a small bill, but it could have a great meaning.
Exactly.
As we move through the process. So let's hear from Mr. Hartman, and then we'll go to Jenny Quinn and Quinn Cheney, I should say. From the department. So let's hear from you first, and then we'll come over to you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is an agency bill that got delayed and therefore didn't make it to the Senate in time to be heard originally. And it is a bill that started out in the House as just the Commissioner of Agriculture being added as a member a non-voting consultant to the Board of Animal Health, but in the House, the Commissioner of DNR and the Commissioner of Health were added to it.
Just as a background, the Board of Animal Health's activities are overseen by a 5-member citizen board. That board, by law, is required to be 3 livestock producers, 2 veterinarians. And then there are currently 2 consultants, one that's been there for quite some time, the dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine. That person was a consultant to the board when I first started at the board 18 years ago, so I don't know the history there. It's been there for a long time. And then the director of the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab was added as a consultant during the time I was here. It's probably been 2 or 3 years that that person's been there. And it only makes sense to have the Commissioner of Agriculture and the other commissioners, if they choose to be, as consultants to the board. To let you know, we meet quarterly, and we just had our quarterly meeting yesterday, and there were representatives from all those agencies there, and usually at our meetings they are there. So we are fully supportive of this bill.
Thank you.
I'm Quinn Cheney with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I don't really need to say anything more other than I think that the way that we work together with the department and the Board of Animal Health is even evidenced by the fact that I serve as legislative liaison both for the board and the department. We just work very, very closely, and this just puts it in law.
Any other discussion? Senator Gimsey, what do you want to do with your bill?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that House File 878 be recommended to pass and move to the Senate floor, I believe.
I'm going to do better than that. I'm going to put it on a consent calendar.
Hmm.
If you don't object.
Mr. Chairman, I think I ran into this problem before where a House file can't go onto the consent calendar.
I will ask my... I tell you what, Mike. I'll set it to the consent calendar, and if it's not allowed to be there, it'll just be on the floor. So it'll be the same. Consent calendar just speeds it up just a little bit.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. We appreciate that, Mr. Sure. Chairman.
So, Senator Gimsey moves that Senate File 878 be recommended pass, and we'll refer to the consent calendar. If there's objection, we'll just pull it down to the floor. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? So adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No, it's first I vote.
Senator Sharon, is she here yet?
Senator Sharon?
Well,
then we're going to go to Senator Engelbretson.
Yes, sir.
You have a Senate File 1405.
I do.
Cheat sheet here. I think he's going to move to change the calendar to amendment wherever it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, bringing to you today a bill from the Department of messed up together here. This is a bill, 1405, livestock compensation provision modification that is before you today. And also with me is...
I'm Gear Friso with the Minnesota Department of Ag.
This is a department bill. Before moving forward, Mr. Chair, I would like to make a couple of oral amendments. We didn't have time to put together an amendment, but... If I could, please, four small changes here. If you could take a look at line, I would like to change from line 1-3 the word calendar to fiscal, and the same on line 1.15. Delete calendar there and put fiscal. Line 2.11, delete calendar and add fiscal. Do the same on line 2.14, and I would offer that as an oral amendment.
Does everybody understand the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Now, Senator Gibbs, or Senator Engelbretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. The issue before you here is basically pretty straightforward. It's in regards to the capping of the payment with regards to the loss of both elk as well as livestock due to the rebounding wolf population. And ecological success story, but it creates challenges for farmers and ranchers who must find a way to protect livestock from wolf predation. And also, the Livestock and Crop Depredation Reimbursement Fund is to provide sufficient resources so that Minnesota livestock producers can be reimbursed for wolf depredation of livestock and elk damages to crops. The proposed language creates a $100 minimum claim amount for wolf damage claims and a maximum claim of an amount of $20,000. This change makes the wolf section consistent with the elk section. The proposed language also caps the maximum amount of claims that the department must reimburse at $100,000 per fiscal year. So, with that, I'll turn it over to the gentleman sitting next to me for some further testimony.
Welcome to committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, my name is Geir Friso with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I think Senator Engelbretson has done a very good job summarizing the bill. It's pretty straightforward. We did have run short of funds in past years. I guess I'd point out that we've never had claims exceeding $100,000. Nor have we ever had claims, individual claims, of less than $100, nor more than $20,000. So these provisions should not create problems for livestock producers or crop producers.
Mr. Fraser, when I was in Washington, we also, Senator Scoy had a concern that out there are cows a cow to them, but if you're a rancher or a farmer, and you have a purebred registered top notch animal, it could be worth. I know Angus heifers down in my area. I had a brother-in-law run. They bring $5,000 to $10,000. And does that take into account, or is this poor farmer just going to have to take what you say? If he can prove that the cow is, or is it bull or steer, whatever it is worth the money, can he get up to what it should be?
Senator Victor, he certainly can. He needs to have verification of the value of that animal by either Extension Service or a conservation officer. We have had situations, just as you have explained, where there's been a high-value animal, and the producer has come back to us and provided additional documentation, and we have been able to reimburse them. So we've never in the history that we've had the program denied those sorts of claims.
All they would have to do, and I'm talking about this Angus breeder, he has certified papers, they're registered, and so it would be easy for him to, would that be one case? Senator Scoy?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the witness, I apologize for not catching your name. If you've never had either one of these conditions, what's the purpose of the bill?
Senator Scoy, I think our primary purpose was to have that cap of $100,000, so to protect the department, so we wouldn't have to pull money from other programs. The floor of $100, I think, really was intended to harmonize it with the elk damage, and also, I suppose, to create some discouragement, I guess, to a potential small claim. We do occasionally get claims for poultry, for example. And typically, though, if it's a wolf attack, there's multiple poultry involved, and so it does usually come up to be several hundred dollars. I suppose potentially somebody could put in a claim for a single animal or something, a single duck or something. So it hasn't happened, but we did want to discourage it.
Well, Senator Scoy, I think what we're trying to do is prepare for the unexpected or something that we don't know could happen. Am I Senator Scoy, did I ask you to...
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any further discussions?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Scogan?
Thank you. Just a question on the process. I'm actually, you know, it doesn't really deal with this bill, but I have some cattlemen in the northern part of my district that are concerned about when they lose an animal, usually during calving season, to the wolf. They are having difficulty convincing the agent that it was wolf-related. And there's a lot of frustration. The wolves seem to travel in a pretty tight, narrow band through parts of my country, and they take cattle as they move. But they seem to, the owners seem to have difficulty convincing the agents that that's the problem. Are you aware of that, I guess?
Mr. Chair, Senator, to a limited extent, I have heard comments. I would say it's fairly rare. Generally, if the report comes in fairly soon after the attack, the conservation officer can find evidence, tracks, or whatever. I think it's highly dependent on how soon the rancher discovers the loss, and then that's going to be key to collecting the evidence that they need. But we do have, by statute, we have to rely on their opinion as to whether or not it was wolf loss.
Is there an appeals process?
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, there is no appeal process.
Any other discussion? Not? Senator Engel Ritson, what would you like to do?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I would recommend that Senate File 1405 be passed and moved to wherever you'd like it to be moved to. Right to the floor, actually.
Senator Engelbretson moves that Senate File 1405, as amended, be recommended to pass.
I'm sorry, as amended.
And I'm looking for some direction. I'm going to say floor. To the floor.
Okay, good.
Okay. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? So adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move that Senate File 1472 be removed from the table.
Senator Kubley moves that Senate Files, what was the number again?
1472.
I tabled the motion. He's bringing it off the table. Senator Kubley, tell us what it is.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, that's the extension of the sunset on the swine lagoons. And if this is taken off the table, Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion to reconsider the A3 amendment.
Okay, Senator Cooley, you're on the A3 amendment.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the A3 amendment just dealt with the expansion element that we received some testimony both for and against, but it seemed to be fairly controversial and was holding up the bill, and I'd just soon move the bill forward, Mr. Chair, so I would like to move that the A3 amendment be removed from the bill.
Okay, Senator Kubley, mm-hmm. The A3 amendment
was adopted.
Takes the or expansion or new off. Am I right? Off of the bill?
Well,
Senator Consul, help me get this figure.
Mr. Chairman, the A3 amendment was adopted to the A2 amendment, which expanded the bill to include expansions. so that, and what Senator Kubley is doing is moving to reconsider the A3, because both AA2 was adopted and the A3. And so now if you reconsider the A3, you bring it before you, he can withdraw it or amend it or do anything else with that amendment at that point in time.
Well, in order to get it off of there, we have to.
You have to move to reconsider, Mr. Chairman, the A3 amendment. Okay.
Senator Kubley moves to reconsider adoption of the A3 amendment.
Which was offered, it was offered as an amendment to the A2 amendment, Mr. Chair, so it would be the amendment to the amendment.
Do you understand that? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? So adopted. Now the A3 is off.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the A3 is before you right now. So he before you,
if he wants, he can withdraw it.
Senator Kubley,
that was a motion to reconsider, Mr. Chair. So, I would just then move that the the A3 amendment to the A2 amendment be removed.
He just can withdraw.
Just withdraw it.
You can withdraw that without any kind of a vote. Senator Kubley?
Pardon?
You can do that on your own. You don't need to vote. If you want to just...
All right. Okay, well, then I guess I thought we had acted on that and actually put it on the bill, Mr. Chair. Well,
you reconsidered that.
Senator Castle, my...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kubley, when it was adopted to the bill, but you already had the motion to reconsider. Once it's reconsidered, it's not on the bill anymore. It's in front of you, and you can withdraw it since you're the author of that.
All right. At that point. Okay. Well, I would withdraw the A3 amendment then, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Now, I see some hands up. Was that Senator Coring? Do you have a...
Well, and then, just for clarification, so then we're back to the A2 amendment as that was originally came before the committee, correct?
Right.
That's correct.
Senator Coring, what we're really doing is the main thing of A2 is the dates from 2007 to 2012. That's simple. It's simple.
Yep.
We're all okay with that.
Everybody understand
yep.
that?
Yep.
Did you have to? You have to move?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the bill is as amended by the A2 amendment in front of you right now. So the only motion needed at this point is a motion to pass or vote on it.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 1472 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Environment.
As amended.
Senator Kubley moves that Senate File 1472 be recommended as amended be recommended to pass and sent to where?
Environment.
Finance?
To the Environment Committee, Mr. Chair.
Is that Environment Policy or just
Policy?
To Environment. Okay.
Environment
Everybody
Policy.
Do you understand that motion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? So adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now,
Senator Sharon here?
Is Senator Sharon here?
Senator X Ropes.
Senator Ropes will take yours up.
Okay.
Senate File 1589.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm just presenting a little overview on this bill today. It's just we've changed it from a request to pass to just an informational presentation. It's Senate File 1589, and I see some of my stakeholders aren't here, so it's a good thing it's just an informational bill. This bill was brought to me by a couple of union workers who worked for the railroad, were concerned about exposure to pesticides along the railroad right-of-ways, and they had some concerns about workers being exposed to pesticides before they dried on the vegetation and how equipment and such were being washed down and that sort of thing. There was a bill put together. And as I try to do, working with stakeholders, bringing people together and bringing a consensus bill before you, it became apparent that as we're working with the railroaders, the railroad lobbyists, the railroad employees, and the Department of Agriculture, it turned out that a couple sections of the bill were already written into statute. Some of the concerns... are addressed in federal worker protection standards and some in OSHA standards, And so we are working on whittling this bill down to probably just a couple paragraphs because some of it's already in statute. So what I would put before you today, and also recognizing that it's probably going to have to go through two or three other committees, and that won't happen before tomorrow, that we'll just let you know we're working on it and intend to bring it back next session.
Senator Rolfe, maybe we should hear from the railroad representatives if they'd like to just add a few words, and then this bill will be laid over because I don't believe you want it to go any further than...
Yeah, it's just informational today, and the railroad folks are not here, but we have Greg from the Department of Ag, and Greg.
Okay. Let's hear a few words from you, and then we'll move on. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Greg Bozicki. I'm with the Department of Agriculture and manage the pesticide and fertilizer programs. When this bill came forward, we have talked with the parties involved, the railroads, the representative of the railroad employees. We were concerned about some of the situations that they have described, and so we're going to continue working with them and making sure that they're aware of the ability to provide information or complaints to us if those are necessary, and work with the railroads. We have done that in the past. And with regards to the bill, we'll continue to work with Senator Erickson Ropes as she works through this process, and we'd be happy to work with all the parties.
So, Mr. Chair, just letting everyone know it's in the pike, and we're up against deadlines. It won't be passing through all the committees needed, and we're still finessing some language.
Senator Dale.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Erickson Ropes, this bill deals with pesticides.
Yes, sir.
What is your definition of a pesticide?
I'm sure that's in statute somewhere, Senator Dale. And this is one of the things, Senator, that we're coming across as we're trying to put together this bill. I think when it was originally crafted, there was some understanding that it was going to be easier for us to get at the concerns of the employees, and it turns out that it's rather a complicated bill. It's going to take us probably a little bit more time, but your question having to do with the definition of pesticide, I'm sure is in federal statute somewhere. We need to dig that out.
Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Erickson Ropes, it's in the very chapter that you're trying to amend or add to. And it includes, pesticides includes all kinds of things. If you look at the definition of pest, it includes insects, rodents, nematodes, fungi, weeds, plant and animal life, viruses, bacteria, other organisms. In other words, the gist of it is that pesticides mean that's just a general word that means all kinds of things, bactericides, viricides, fungicides. So you think of herbicides and insecticides and so forth. But this is really a terrible bill, to tell you the truth. And I think you should put it in a circular file and spend any more time on it. And if you take a look at what this bill is asking the railroads to do is to tell the Department of Agriculture by March 15th of each year when they're going to spray their pesticides. How can you tell? It might be raining. And you're supposed to do it 9 months out. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. How can you tell when it's going to be raining or the wind's going to be blowing too much? I mean, you just can't do it. You have to make judgments day by day as to when you're going to do it. And on top of that, you're talking about pesticides, which is a broad term that means everything. So if the railroad is out there cleaning their toilets with a bactericide, and I hope they use a bactericide, it would be a good idea.
Senator Chair.
What you got in here is you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dale, a point taken, and which is why it's an informational bill today. It's not ready. And we're going to be continuing to work on it over the summer. I have been joined.
I think your bill says it takes – you can't – if you use a bactericide to clean the toilet, you can't use it for 168 hours. Unless you tell us about how dangerous it is.
Senator Ropes, I should have warned you when you start with something with pesticide, Dale's going to react over in this table. Okay,
then there's
we have
the issue of rats in the warehouse. You can't tell when the rats are going to show up 9 months in advance. And you need to put the rodenticide down when they show up. And then to tell the workers they can't go in the warehouse for another 168 hours and so forth. I mean, it's just so full of ridiculous ideas. And I could go on and on and on, but I think the best thing for you to do with this thing is put it in a circular file and not bother with it anymore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Dell. Mr. Chair, I have been joined by Carl Knudsen, who's with the railroad employees, and I'll let him just say a word or two about what brought some of the concerns to this bill, and we will continue to work on over the summer.
Mr. Chairman.
Briefly, let's hear from the railroad and then we're going to...
My name is Carl Knudsen. I'm with the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees. And I drafted the original language with the objective of getting discussion going, and it apparently worked. We did have a delete all prepared that involved notice to employees and education to inform them of what pesticides were being used, things of that nature. We will be working on this over the summer with the railroads and with the Department of Agriculture. But the short form is that every issue that we raise, with the exception of the 168 hours, every issue we raise is designed to address a problem we've had. We've had helicopter spray crew, helicopter herbicide applicators spraying our crews while they're in the field. We've had train crews sprayed in their locomotives. When someone has asked a supervisor that is this dangerous, the supervisor's response is it's not a problem as long as you don't lick the switch stand. And the issue needs to be addressed, and that's what we're trying to do here. I appreciate your time, and I'm trying to be brief.
Mr. Chair, that's all we have.
Okay. Senator Robes, thank you for the short presentation, and I believe that you want it just kind of – you want to let it set here. You got some work to do.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you.
Last bill up today is Senator Sharon. That is Senate File 1343. Sharon, welcome to
Thank you, Chairman Vickerman. I'm here to. My name is Kathy Sharon. I'm here to present Senate File Number 1343. With me to present and to answer your questions from the Department of Natural Resources. It's been a long day here. All these letters is Mr. Bob Tomlinson, and from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture is Mr. Geir Friso. So they will be able to answer the specific questions to you about an agency bill that's being brought forward in order to help better define and clarify the relationship between the two divisions and their role in terms of dealing with forest and shade tree pests. It also it's important to understand that this bill will allow the DNR to update and amend its current statutes and reflect changes in technology and their program emphases. It will also shift the responsibility for community. Community is the critical word there, community forest management, from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to the DNR. And it will help more clearly match the functions and the responsibilities to the department's missions. It might be helpful to know that in 2003, there was a statute assigning pest control responsibility to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and then was amended to more strongly focus on potentially damaging invasive pests such as the not-yet-established emerald ash borer. These changes, now what's important about what the emphasis I want to make on that first statement was focusing on potentially damaging. So we're talking about something that's not yet invaded but a potentially invasive species. Those changes corresponded with the historic mission of the two agencies, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture overseeing the management of pests not yet established. That's the critical piece of that in this state. And then the DNR overseeing the management of forest pests permanently established. So it's that sense of prevention versus dealing with something that's already been invasive. The bill further clarifies the respective pest management missions of the agencies. And the Department of Agriculture and Natural Resources have long supported each other in their respective missions, and they'll continue to do so effectively as they're here to testify and in order to answer your questions.
Let's hear from the other two witnesses, and then we'll open it up.
Mr. Chair, my name's Bob Tomlinson, the Deputy Director of the DNR Division of Forestry.
And I'm Gear Friso with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Mr. Chair, members, this was a DNR bill that we brought forth. We did work with agriculture for several months over the summer months and leading up to session to kind of go through and come up with this language, which, as Senator Sharon emphasized, it's there to, in part, clarify the respective roles of the agencies as it relates to forest and shade tree pests. That's the main thing. MDA retains the existing authority that they have to provide community grants for the purpose of containment and eradication of new or emerging invasive pests such as emerald ash borer. Again, it's for the purpose of containment and eradication. DNR then retains our authority and expands our existing authority to provide community health grants for a broad range of activities meant to promote urban and community forest health, including grants to control and establish forest pests. It also, another purpose of the bill is to expand the range of forestry practices eligible for cost sharing under the current Minnesota Relief Program, which was established by the LCMR initially. It's probably been close to 20 years ago that was established in the DNR, and the focus has been primarily on energy. It originally was on energy conservation tree planting. We, however, have been using that program to administer grants for things such as oak wilt control up in the northern suburban counties of the Twin Cities and for other practices like that. So we want to update the statutes, if you will, to kind of reflect that or update that part of it that relates to the Minnesota Relief to have a little broader term. Another purpose of the bill, primary purpose of the bill, is to shift the Certified Tree Inspector Program administration from MDA to the DNR. And while shifting the authority, the intent is to maintain what has been a successful program. I believe they just had the shade tree short course last week, if I'm not mistaken, and I heard there were some 900 tree inspectors that went through that course from around the state. And that's one that, unfortunately, we can't take a lot of credit for. It's really the University of Minnesota that does a lot of that work, and we will continue to work closely with the U of M college over there that does that. But the key on this is the administration of that effort. We'll keep the database in DNR. It'll be moved from agriculture over to us and actually send out the certification to those folks that successfully complete that program each year. And then another primary focus of the bill is to better integrate urban and community forestry resource protection within DNR mandates and authorities as a critical component of the state's natural resources. So we've kind of broadened, if you will, the authorities of the Commissioner of Natural Resources and relative to community forestry activities. The bill does not change the following. MDA is full authority to survey, contain, and eradicate new or emerging invasive pests such as the emerald ash borer, Asian longhorn beetle and those types of pests like that. It does not impede DNR's full authority to monitor and manage forest health, including managing invasive forest pests that have already become permanently established, such as oak wilt, Dutch elm disease, and those types of pest-related things. And also that MDA and DNR will continue to work hand-in-hand with our federal partners, being the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, USDA Forest Service, and other folks to monitor and control invasive pests. And there are a number of interagency working groups organized to address the various facets of invasive species issues. So that in essence, is what the bill does and what it doesn't. I could walk through the bill section by section for you if you care, but many of you have already heard this in the Environment Committee. And with that, I guess, unless Mr. Friesel might add something from the agriculture's perspective, but that demands what the bill will
committee
do.
Committee, state your name for the record.
I'm Geer Friesel with Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I think Mr. Thomason has done a great job explaining the bill. We have worked very closely with DNR on this bill. Just a little more background on the original shade tree statutes that were part of agriculture statutes in 18G, I think they were originally part of agriculture because that was when Dutch elm disease first came to Minnesota. So that was very much agriculture's responsibility to try and exclude and eradicate it. There was a lot of funding for the program up through the 80s, but then the funding was lost in about mid-80s. Dutch elm disease, as you know, has become widespread in Minnesota and has caused a great deal of devastation. And it just seemed like a natural fit now that the disease is established to move it in with DNR. They have a min relief program, which is also a very good program. So it's a good fit. It preserves our statutory authority. So we're very supportive of this bill.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just have a question on page 2 of the bill, section subdivision 27, lines 2.14 to 1.6. It defines community forest, and I take that to be a new term that hasn't existed in statute before, and it's defined as public and private trees and associated plants. And the question I have is the bill seems to give some authority to the department over community forests, which would include, I assume, private property, private lands. And I think I understand what the intent of what we're trying to do here is. We want to manage problems that may occur in the trees. But does this present any conflicts with perhaps any of the provisions under eminent domain with respect to takings provisions? In other words, if there's a dispute between the department and the property owner about what's going on in their trees and who has a jurisdiction over that, does this – I don't know. I'm just trying to find out, since this is a new term, whether this presents some kind of potential conflict of interest between the interests of the state in the form of the department and the interests of private property owners.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, I'm unaware of it having created that sort of a dilemma up to this point. I'm not sure if DNR has passing the buck here.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is a DNR provision, I guess. It's the community forest definition would go in. Basically, what we're doing there is just making a definition for community forest. You know, we provide in DNR assistance. You know, obviously, we manage a large state land, public land base, but we also provide technical assistance and a significant amount of cost share dollars over the last decade or more, a couple of decades, to private forest landowners around the state. In addition to that, we've had an ongoing community forestry program. This is just formalized, where we're providing assistance to communities. And basically, our assistance there is primarily, I like to suggest that it's building capacity, if you will, within the communities, helping them do inventories helping them have tree inspectors, you know, technical expertise on staff, providing some cost share dollars and grants when it comes available, those sorts of things like that. By and large, no, we don't plan on going in anybody's backyards or private properties unless we're invited. And even then, we don't have the wherewithal just staff-wise and things to be doing that, an awful lot of that.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Thompson, I appreciate that. And I think, as I said, I believe I understand what the practice has been and what the intent is. But over on page 4 under section 15, it talks about forest plans, and it's talking about the sort of the authority of the department to manage certain things, among which are these community forests. And all I'm trying to understand is if by creating this new definition and creating some jurisdictional authority of the department over that entity, have you created some potential dispute where someone says, well, now, wait a minute, this is my land, and here you've got something going on where they're doing planning and doing things that involves my land, and I don't know. I'm just trying to raise the question of whether by creating this definition, instead of leaving it the way it had been handled, which has been more on advice and individual, I just am not sure whether that has created a potential problem. And maybe there are others, maybe there's some who are attorneys, of which I am not, who might be a better versed in understanding that question.
Mr. Chair, if we certainly can look into that further and get more information to you about that. I would draw your attention to page 10, where it talks about enforcement officer powers. It talks about a variety of powers, but the one that specifically to this is enter any land and carry out the duties and functions of the division, and that's what that you're concerned about. And I'm certainly not an attorney either, but I know that there is a legal process whenever any department in the state makes a ruling to remove a tree and there's a dispute about that, that there's a normal court process and procedure and mediation process that any one can engage in.
Well, and thank you, and Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Sharon. And I'm not trying to hold up the bill at all. I guess if we had earlier looked at this, I might have suggested we take it to the Judiciary Committee and let that body have at it for a while. But I think it would be a good question to at least answer. I think I understand what the intent is, and I support that. I just am worried that if you create a property rights conflict in law, then you maybe got a lawsuit down the road somewhere. So.
Members, I think what we're trying to do here is if you live in certain parts of this city, north of your ways, they got a lot of oak trees. Take 100 years to get them up there. And once that disease gets there, you just about got it. It don't go away. You got to take it down. And the other part is it maple or is it ash? They have another one. You see the X's marked. I think that's what you're trying to do is offer some encouragement, some help to be sure how you handle that. That's the first thing I would do. If I had an oak tree, I'd do my best to save it, but you really can't because they just and then it spreads to the neighbor where the houses are. I would welcome him to come on my property, but maybe if he was up the Northern Woods where he had 10,000 acres, but I'm talking about just places within the city. Even where I live, we don't have any oak trees, but you can get that. What is it? I think it's ash. Is it ash or maple? One of those. They just die. There's just no way around it. They just die. Let's see, who had a question? Senator Engelbretson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was confused earlier. You said you didn't want any trees down there. Now you... I get confused the longer we get along here. So. Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much, Chairman Vickerman. I would also just draw your attention to the page 10. We are not changing any language that wasn't already in place there in terms of authority. So... It's just important to note that we're just simply adding language here, not adding authority or duties or processes that haven't been in place for a long time, especially to deal with Elm.
Okay, members, I think we kind of all know what we're doing here, so I'm looking for somebody. And Senator Dill, would you like to move this?
Where do you want to move it to?
It's going to go on the floor.
Okay, I move that Senate file 1343 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor.
Senator Dill moves that Senate file 1343 be recommended to pass and be referred to the floor. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. I don't believe there's anything more on the list, so we are adjourned today.